I can't tell you how many of you have submitted your Spotify playlists to me. I don't give out my personal email just because, like you, I don't. But people ask me if they could, you know, for one, through one reason or means or another, including someone that put it in our car up in Connecticut, who somehow was up there for the day. Literally, that actually happened. I have received about 20 playlists from people in the group, and I was very delighted and happy that that this was the case. And I want to continue that theme of the playlist that you would give to Saint Peter in the traditional mythos, the playlist that you would carry with you when you die, that would most express the deepest feelings and emotions and even person that you've become. Very often when you bury people in the ministry, in the days when there were still sort of interments or full casket interments, people would often do what the ancient Egyptians did and Neolithic culture did. They would actually put in the casket with the loved one things that they thought summed up their life. And I was burying a woman of about 38 who had died of cancer, and her husband, who was completely and totally wiped out by his wife's death, as we were bending over the place where her body was resting at the cemetery, his glasses, and they were a very expensive, just because that's the way it is today, his own actual glasses, not prescription sunglasses, as he was bending over where his wife's casket was just about to be covered over with earth, they fell into the opening. And he was so completely undone by the whole situation that he said, that's a sign, no sweat. And he left his glasses because it was such a powerful personal expression of him and everything that at that moment he acquiesced in their being with her. And that was very striking. I think I've told you that the first 10 minutes of every talk is completely non-substantial time, because you listen to a person, you want to think you've just eaten, maybe there's someone that's in the room that you're uncomfortable with or that you would like to be comfortable with, or you're thinking about something that you just, Jim's sermon just made you think about, or some condition or circumstance. So it takes most people about 10 minutes to kind of cool their jets, to be able to hear what is being stated. So that's why I'm just going to sort of dither around the general area for the first 10 minutes of the talk. I'm going to introduce the subject. This will last about 30 minutes. And I think it's important that a person say that, because sometimes people go on forever. And even if it's interesting, you can't TMI, you know. You get to the point when you sort of want to say, when is he going to shut up? So I'm just, even if it's good. So this is about 30 minutes, maybe a trifle more, because it's going to wind it all up. And then there'll be some Q&A or discussion. What happens to us when we die is most powerfully represented for me in literature by the vision that Jacob Marley offers to Ebenezer Scrooge at the beginning of A Christmas Carol, because Marley is covered with chains representing the chains that he had attached to his money box during his life, his avarice. And he is trying to wake up Ebenezer Scrooge, his old business partner. And he says, look out the window, Ebenezer! And they go to the window, and the snow is swirling, and Scrooge sees men and women of all ages whirling through in their earthly evanescent form with large, like luggage, attached to their ankles. He sees a vision of men and women in the thousands, almost, it appears, almost infinite, of men and women skating across the sky with vast, sort of like anvils, attached to their legs by means of chains. And remember that song by the Beatles, Chains? My baby's got me all wrapped up in chains, but they ain't the kind that you can see. I'm trying to lighten it up while being serious. And Marley turns to Scrooge and says, these are the chains that these souls wrought in life. Now, what I want to say is very, very painful. It's painful to me, and it's painful to every human being. And it is the following. When you die, at a certain perspective, it's over. That is to say, at the moment of death, you can't do anything else. Now, you remember the musical Hair, and you may remember that the very controversial and famous co-writer and actor in the musical Hair that was first performed not very far from where we're seated was named Jerome Ragni, R-A-G-N-I, and he was a massive acting-out hippie. But he came from a very, very conservative Roman Catholic family in Pittsburgh. Jerome Ragni, who died very young, he had an equally famous brother, but in the sight of God. Because Jerome Ragni's brother was a Catholic priest named Richard Ragni, whom they still speak about in Pittsburgh, the Catholic Church. And Richard Ragni, Father Ragni, very famously said, and no one who heard him say it ever forgot it, Richard Ragni said, at death, the time for doing is over. Now, one of the reasons we know this, and my main point for the whole talk comes under the heading of a big word, and don't worry, I'll tie this together, God willing. The word is extrapolation. That's the word I want you to go out remembering. Gosh, why did I come to this talk? The word I hope you're going to remember is extrapolation. Because while great literary figures and wise people over the centuries are correct in saying, death from whose born no traveler returns, right? Death from whose born no traveler returns, said Hamlet. There are things that we know about what our life is like after death because we can extrapolate them from things that are true now. So if someone says, Paul, how can you possibly set yourself up to talk about life after death when no one has come back? Except, obviously, from my point of view, one, but even he, I haven't met personally in the way that the disciples did. So people will say, how can you talk about what lies beyond the veil when no one's ever come back? And this is why you can. Because you can extrapolate from life now certain things about life that are lasting as opposed to things about your life that are passing away. For example, St. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, faith, hope, and love abide. But he also said, there's no faith in the afterlife. He says it specifically. We won't need faith in the afterlife because we will see. So faith falls the moment you die, no more faith. He also said, there's no hope because the thing that we had hoped for is come to pass. So there's no need for hope. It's like when you get married, you know, there's certain uncertainties that you can, in theory, jettison when you get married if she means it or if he means it. Humanly, it's always mezzo mezzo. But in theory, but in when you die, St. Paul says, there's no more need for faith and there's no more need for hope. Love, on the other hand, abides. And that's why love is in a different category. Now, do you see what I mean about extrapolation? Extrapolation is extrapolation from what's meaningful to me now and what works and what lasts versus what clearly and obviously collapses. Now, I say that because this is why when Father Ragni said that after death, the time for doing is over, that's unarguable. In other words, that has to be true. Why? Because the person that dies, you've seen them. That person, now there may be a part of them, which we can talk about, but that person called Paul Zoll or whoever it is, he, at least, whatever he was about, is over. I mean, have you spent any time at funerals of people you loved? Everybody here has bound to have been to one. And the Episcopal Church has always, you probably don't know this, but until very recently, there was a hard and fast rule that you never had an open casket, either at a funeral or at a wake, which is not an Episcopalian term, or at a viewing. You never had an open casket. So it wasn't really a viewing. It was an exercise in carpentry. But now the Episcopal Church had a reason for that. I won't go into it. I won't go into that. But expensive, overpriced carpentry. But if you've seen your mother in death, I recently have, but you have seen someone you love in death, haven't you immediately thought that she's no longer there? I mean, she may be somewhere else in a different form, and I'm not denying that for a moment, but that person who was my mother, that's over. The attachment of soul and body that I knew and loved and cared for and who loved me and fed me and did all the things that she did, that project is concluded. Now, it may at a future time be resurrected in a different form, 1 Corinthians also later on, but as far as Paul Zoll is concerned, once he's lying in that casket or his ashes are there, the project known as me, the attachment of soul and body that is me, that is over. Another way of saying this is that your soul is frozen when you die. It's frozen in time. Now, this is very heavy, but I think I'm on solid ground because it's experientially the case. It's empirically unarguable that the project known as you, when the people looking at you see you there, that project is over. It's you can't argue that, because if it were not over, she'd be getting up. That's why Lazarus is the great exception. Poor Lazarus. Can you guess how many books have been written, novels, about the life of Lazarus after Jesus raised him from the dead? Well, let's start with 25. Did you know that Anatole France wrote a story about Lazarus' life afterwards? It's always French novelists. French novelists are very interested in Lazarus after he was risen from the dead. What do we say today? Go figure. What I want to say is that I put this out to you, but it's so opprobriously obvious that Father Ragni told the truth when he said it's over. And Charles Dickens instinctively saw, in the sense that the souls of the departed, who had departed with anvils of regret, loosed, attached to their bodies, had no possibility at that point of doing anything about it. And that's why I'm not telling you a story that's liberal. Charles Dickens, it's an absolute cardinal point of A Christmas Carol and Dombey and Son, where this occurs again. So, that being the case, what I'm talking to you about is of urgent importance for everyone sitting in this room. And it's become so important to me that it's basically what I think about all the time. The question that you have to ask yourself today, and I am going to give you some fun as the time goes on, the question you have to ask yourself today, what is attached to your leg that is not yet unattached from your leg? What are you carrying? It doesn't necessarily mean a sin of something you've done. It can be just something about you that you have never been able to have peace about. Something in your experience of life, a kind of a disability or a deep sense of unworthiness, the kind of thing that Jim was speaking about. Because personally, I thought that his illustration was absolutely human. I, too, would like to take every mirror out of the... I'm at the stage of life when I look okay, people say, from the head to the neck. But and I'm wearing a dark sweater. I'm told that if you wear black or dark, it covers up a beer belly, or in this case, a wheat belly. And I get up in the morning, and I become a howling wraith of desperate, urgent failure when I look at myself from the chest, shall we say, to the belt. And what... I want to say about that is I've learned, people say that if you have your photograph taken and you're worried about your tummy, always pose yourself at an angle. Have you heard that? If you have my Instagrams, I've learned this constantly now. And it's amazing. If you're wearing dark clothing and you're at an angle, your tummy, if you have a tummy, seems to disappear. Now, I say that because... You're carrying something, and it may just be something about your very self. What therapists use is the word shame. It's almost a buzzword now, but let's put it on the table. And that's the thing. You want that to be dealt with to the best of your ability before your soul is frozen, as far as we know, at death. Now, I've often said this, and I'm sure you've heard me say it if you listen to my podcast or whatever that is, that the greatest group in the history of rock and roll, that group after whom nothing more could be said in terms of popular music was, now, that the greatest group in the history of American rock and roll, after which nothing new or fresh could be said musically, was... Everyone, obviously, Journey. Now, I say that intentionally because when I say it, people look at me with incomprehension. But if you actually study the evidence, you'll soon agree. Now, the thing about Journey is that they came on the shoulders of the second greatest group in the history of American rock and roll. If Journey was the first greatest group in the history of rock and roll, what is the group out of which the vision, musical vision, Journey came? Foreigner. Now, Foreigner, I'm surprised you're not howling on the ground at this point, but you must think I'm more serious than I am. But they did, this is all part of that 10 minutes, they did a song called... What is the song by Foreigner that relates directly to what I'm saying? Oh, wow. Damn. No, urgent. Urgent. Urgent, urgent. Emergency. Urgent, 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 urgent. Emergency. Now, what I'm trying to say, and I know it's a little heavy, but you can handle it. You can just disagree. What I'm trying to say in light of the Christmas Carol, Marley's colleagues... former colleagues, is that this question of what are you carrying at present that could at any moment travel with you. These are the non-reconciled facts, either of your personal history or your being or experience, whatever you want to call it. Those facts will go with you afterwards because they have to be dealt with. They simply somehow they have to be dealt with. And this is where the Roman Catholic teaching of purgatory, which I personally I've always been uncomfortable with that teaching, but nevertheless, you can see what a comfort it is, oddly enough, to some people. Because if I have a second chance, you know, I can work it out later, that would be a comfort. And if you could pray for me to have the chance to work out these things, I would be very grateful. Now, what the first point then is that there is an urgent need for human beings to rectify things about your life that are amiss. This is why God has given humanity an odd experience. People, when they get older, get nostalgic. Now, you may not have noticed this. People, as they get older, your parents, you, people you live with and care for, become compulsively nostalgic. And they often fixate on two or three situations or instances that are that are from their past that they can't shake. Do you identify at all with this? You find yourself, the older you get, in your mind, and you don't like it, gradually going back to certain epochs or certain people or situations that sometimes are from the distant past, and it surprises you. And as someone last week said, in my opinion, perceptively, this is what Citizen Kane is about, the movie. That's what it's about. It's a man who, the older he gets, the more transfixed and compulsive he becomes in focusing on one particular negative memory. He doesn't know why, he doesn't know what, but he knows that the older he gets, the more disturbed he becomes in thinking about something that happened to him when he was 8. And as you know, he dies uncomprehending. The last word on his lips as he dies, and he's a brilliant, successful person, he based on a real man, he says the word, but neither he nor anyone else who's known him understands the significance of it. So what I'm trying to say to you is that whatever you're thinking about that you can't quite get over from your history, that is going to be something that will accompany you into the afterlife. Why? Extrapolation. In the same way that you can extrapolate that the project known as Paul Zoll is over when he dies, that project, in the same way, this human incredible heat-seeking missile that begins to isolate certain experiences that you had is God's way of saying, there's something here. Now, there's a movie. I don't mind. I think everybody should have their cell phones on. Can I tell you a great story? My hero, Burton Cummings, he's my hero, the Guess Who singer that I talked about. He starts every concert. This is what he says. Usually they're small concerts because he's not that famous. And he starts every concert by saying, you know, I just want you to know I'm not a video Nazi. You can record, photograph, and tape record every single note of this concert. Isn't that great? He could care less about the so-called royalties. He happens to be a very rich man because he doesn't care. He's not possessive. Now, what I want to say then is, on the one hand, it's over when it's over, and this is why it's very urgent. And secondly, whatever's really going into that Spotify list has to do with something really important emotionally. Let me give you another example. There's a movie that you've got to see, but you just need to see 30 minutes of it, and it's on YouTube. You can look at it right tonight. It's called Appointment in London. And it was made in 1942. And it is, I feel like a rock singer in the old days. It's so cool to do that. And it's called Appointment in London. And it is part of a harvest of movies that were made after or during World War II about British Bomber Command. Now, don't worry. This is directly relevant. Millions of movies, 10, were made right after World War II about British Bomber Command and RAF bombers and some American bombers, but these were English movies, as they passed over Germany after the Battle of Britain, bombing targets in Germany. And the way they did it, they didn't have radar. The way they did it, an appointment in London, look it up on YouTube, they give you the 20 minutes. It's the most vivid, verisimilitudinous movie of what the actual facts of being in a British RAF Lancaster bomber over Mainz, Germany, was actually like. And why is it so authentic? Because it was made in 1942, and the technical advisors were all pilots who had done it in 1941. And what they would do is they would fly over the German city, but they had no radar. And everything was blacked out on the ground. They would send a small fighter plane ahead of the phalanx of 167 or 467 Lancaster bombers. They would send a little plane called a Pathfinder. Do you all know this? They would send a Pathfinder. And the Pathfinder's job, with a brilliant navigational person, and they were dark, they were completely darkened, and they flew very low, they would find the target. And then when they got over the target, let's say a ball bearing factory in Bremerhaven, Germany, they would drop flares. And they would drop flares over the marker, and then the Pathfinder pilot would radio back and said, "I've just dropped green flares over the marker. So find the green flares, and then you'll know where to bomb." They had no radar. And he would then go around, and they almost all got shot down. He would then swing around, do it again, and drop the markers on the target. Now, the Germans got wise to this very quickly, and they would send little unmarked planes of their own and drop different colored markers over fields. And many, many British planes either collided or missed the market because of the German decoys. But in the movie, you hear a true life recording of the Pathfinder pilot in front of the large squadron of Lancaster bombers, about 4 miles. And this is how it goes. "I've dropped..." This is actually a recording from real life. It's shocking. I mean, Mary and I couldn't believe it. We were just... It's so upsetting because it's real. And he says something like this. He's got a funny, raspy voice. "Dropped the markers over... Dropped the markers over target. I've dropped the marker. Green markers. Green markers." Then he says, "Watch for the green markers. Not the red. Not the red. The green. The green." And then... pow, and two or three bombers collide and go down. And then he says, "You missed the markers, the green markers." And then suddenly, pow, "I'm hit, I'm hit." Now, this is actually recordings that were recorded over radio transmissions. Now, why do I say that? Your Spotify playlist, certain elements of it were the green marker. Your nostalgia or your memory, you have a bitter memory of a parent. You have a bitter memory of a teacher. You have a bitter memory of a man. You have a bitter memory of a woman. You have a bitter memory of a classmate. And those are the markers that will take you to where the target of your life actually is. The connection between the real diagnosis and what's really happening. And there will be plenty of, the world will give you deceptive markers
Not the red markers. Not the red. No, not the red markers.
But these guys were dying. And you will too. Because if you take the wrong marker, if you think, oh, this is really because they didn't like me because I was such and such, or it's really because of them, or it was that group of people over there, or it was my diet. I mean, all of which could be possibly true. But as I told you last week, diets never work. I'll just lay that on the line. Never ultimately work. I don't care what it is. Don't get upset. Pretend I never said it. Now... Okay, now, the world will tell you that the marker for your life is that you didn't get accepted at Carnegie Mellon, or you didn't, you know, this girl that you really liked didn't realize how wonderfully hopeful you would be. That's what the world will tell you. And sometimes there's an element of truth, but the marker is almost always a hurt. And usually... it's a rejection. The actual fact of the matter is that the marker is usually, because love is so important to us, some form of rejection in love. Now, let me go on and talk about get this right. Let's talk about some examples and extrapolation and meditation, and I'll conclude with a song. We are going to listen to a marker today. It happens to be on my Spotify list, and it's only 50 years old. So y'all say, oh, you know, are we going to listen to Lawrence Welk? You know, no. When you hear it, if you're my age, y'all understand it. But you don't have to be my age. It's one of the great markers of the human race from an unusual source. Now, then we're going to listen to it. I'm going to comment on it. We're going to listen to it again, and we're done. Let me just parenthetically, I wanted to add one thing. This is important. Last week, I said that crisis, or death, the threat of death always deconstructs what's not important. It, you know, it deconstructs the myth of career. And believe me, that myth should be deconstructed. I can't help it that you think it is true, but if it will be deconstructed, I will lay you 100% odds that unless you're a total anomaly like Barbara Streisand, your sense of she's the complete anomaly, but I'm not inside her head. You know, but I can assure you that your career as a enduring goal, you will not take it past the end of the project. It will not go past you. You will not care. I've often been with people who are dying, and not one single time have they ever evinced regrets concerning their career. Not one single time. As this is especially a problem with men in the old days, not once have I heard a man express regrets in his career. One man expressed regrets that he had gone to jail for fraud involving a mail order company, but it was because he had hurt his wife. That's what the regret was. But I've never, ever once heard a person express regret about their career. But another deconstruction, and this is a piggyback from last week, is your possessions. It's obvious, but Mary pointed out that I hadn't mentioned it. But if anyone here actually believes that anything that you actually have that is tangible has any lasting significance, I pity you, but many people do believe this, and I understand it. I mean, I adore I go to Union Square, and for $1, I get the greatest DVDs in the history of the world. I mean, I have eight of them that I got. Yeah, I got Hair for $1. I got Adam Age Vampire for $1 from Italy. So life is good, but what I want to say is when you, if you actually think, you'll be sort of like the National Onion article that said this, man retires in order to have more quality time with his toys. The head of GM recently, the member of Congress recently resigned from his office and decided he needed to go for personal reasons. When asked why he had resigned, he said, "I'm at the time of my life when I really need to have more quality time with my possessions." Anyway, let's put that on the side, but I mention it. But the core thing here, I've said that the problem of life is that at death, the project of me and you is finished vis-a-vis action. So you will also find that when you're dying, there may well be one or two things that are, it's usually just one that really stands out, that you have got to deal with. Otherwise, it will go with you. Now, God forgives, but it will go with you if you take it to that point. So I think it is urgent for you to consider this. And the final point, and now I'm going to wrap it up. What do we know about the afterlife? We know that it will not involve possessions. It will not involve any kind of professional aspirations. It will not involve status of any kind. I was with a guy the other day, and it was said of him, you know, he came from a humble background, and all he really wants to do is join every exclusive club he can. His entire life is about joining every so-called exclusive club he can. And I said, well, when will it ever end? The extrapolation is what actually lasts, and this is why this element of looking back at the Spotify playlist, when did you really feel loved? And when did you love? I mean, how many times really did you? You had plenty of relationships, but many of them were lukewarm, miscommunicating, and rejecting. But somewhere in there, it mattered to you, and love was struck, and you would do everything for it. David Ruffin of the Temptations sang, "My whole world ended when you left me." Now, how could he say that? My whole world ended when you left me? I know exactly how he could say that. It's totally true. I've done a podcast, this recently, in which I said, believe the scriptures because you believe rock and roll songs. Wait a minute. I said, don't get all lost in biblical criticism. It's completely beside the point. The things that Jesus and St. Paul said that sound like exaggerations, why should they be exaggerations when everything Glenn Campbell ever sang is not an exaggeration? You're my everything, 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 you're my everything. That is the refrain of the Temptations' famous hit called, "You're My Everything." Now, that's truth. So if the Temptations, when you listen to that song, and you said, "I believe in magic in a young girl's heart," remember that loving spoonful? If you believe that song, why shouldn't you believe the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, these people are totally compartmentalized. Wild Thing, "You Make My Heart Sing." You make everything groovy. Now that's an either or. What I want to say is, you learn about heaven by understanding your own either or-ness. The Trogs didn't say, "Wild Thing, you make my heart sing." I have an ambivalent sense about the nuanced way in which some things were great when you were with me, but other things were relatively uninspired. That's not you. The reality is, "Wild Thing, you make my heart sing. You make everything groovy." I keep wanting to say about these biblical critics, have you never been in love? I often say this about extreme feminists. No, I do. I said, have you ever had the urge to give yourself away? And what is love about except to give yourself completely away? And when you're in love, let me tell you, if you haven't been, but everybody here has been in some way, when you're in love, all bets are off. There is no quantification. There is no degrees. There is no ambivalence or nuance or archaeology or varying different ambiguities. That may be true in France in the 20th century, early 20th century philosophical thought, but David Ruffin said the truth. So I'm going to conclude by asking Kamal to play just a classic Spotify playlist, and it's an old song. We'll listen to it, then I'll explain it. It came out in June of 1968, and it was performed by a singer called Johnny Rivers, who had 11 top five hits, and in my opinion, this is his masterpiece. But hey, let's listen to it, and then I'll talk about it. It starts out with a roll of thunder. How many people have heard that song before? Well, interesting. Let's talk about it for just a minute. Let's talk about it. He did Tracks of My Tears. He did a very white version of Tracks of My Tears. The better one, of course, is Smokey Robinson. He did Tears of a Clown, which is... No, not Tears of a Clown. He did... it'll come back to me. But he had many, many hits. But this song is a massive surgical analysis of what a human being is before God and man. Why is that? First, it totally exaggerates her. She's the sun. But that's how people actually think, especially men. Remember, men have a need to idealize women into massive goddesses. And this makes it very difficult for women because they're much more, generally speaking, anchored. And so they don't quite know how to deal with this because they realize if they're the sun one day, they could have a solar eclipse the next day. And the guy doesn't know it. But then he talks about her in religious terms, Greek mythology terms, and then the great line, the actual original line is, all summer long we were dancing in the sand, and the jukebox kept playing Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Now, what is that singer? Then what is going to be on his Spotify playlist? Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Because he will die canonizing Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. What about you? What is the material? The material that is the equivalent of that. And then he has the incredibly lame but totally touching line. She wants to live in the Rockies. She says that there we'll find peace. We'll find a home, raise a home and a family to call our own. Oh, I mean, who here isn't just totally dissolved in sympathy for this poor man? Is he going to get to the Rockies? Absolutely not. John Denver, it turns out, had never been to Colorado. Did you know that? John Denver was not a Coloradan. John Denver, who wrote Colorado Rocky Mountain High, had never been to Colorado. Johnny Rivers, who masqueraded himself as an Appalachian, Nashville-oriented country music. Do you know where Johnny Rivers grew up? Brooklyn. So all life is based on artifice. Nothing is true. The way you present yourself today, it has nothing to do with the reality. A little bit. But the actual reality of you is completely not what you appear to be. But he has this idea that in this love that he has found with this son, and accompanied by this music and this psychosexual euphoria of dancing in the sand, he's going to go to the Rockies. Well, who here hasn't thought that? Well, I'm amazed, because I think about it all the time. Although obviously I don't. Now, because I want you to approve of me as a very sober citizen. So that's my talk. Thank you for listening. I wanted to say that, A, it is urgent that we understand that at death, the time for doing is over. Now is your chance to go into therapy. Or, I mean, what did we always say, Mary, with our children? What did we say? Our prayer for our three sons was always this, that they would know when it was time to go into therapy. Or not just therapy, it could be some other thing. Now is the time for the relationship. Now is the time to work on yourself. Now is the time to deal with whatever it is. And the second thing I said was that in the same way that your pain, God gives you a marker. Follow the marker. What you're thinking about as I'm talking is the marker. It's not what the internet is telling me. It's not what YouTube is telling me, and it's not what the papers are telling me. It's what's actually happening inside here. And if people knew what was really going on inside your mind, they would be blown away. Because in fact, you're obsessed with something, but it's not what they think it is. It's completely different from what your friends think it is. That's the marker. And thirdly, and most importantly, Johnny Rivers' very brilliant song called Summer Rain shows us that the thing which counts is romantic love, which is almost always based on the possibility of equality. It's not maternal and parental love. That love does not go on beyond the grave because it's not sanctified. It's intrinsic. It's natural. It's in our genes. The love that really you will be thinking about when you are dying is the person that was an equal that expressed love for you. And that is what you will carry on the other side. And that is why we always say that if you want to know what heaven is like, feel the way that this poor man felt before he was disillusioned. Okay, thank you for this. We have a few minutes for questions or comments.